from Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Good afternoon. Yeah, when I'm talking to the TV camera, I'm not going to wear a mask, and all of us have been immunized, so...
It'd make us feel better.
You're welcome to step away if you like. The whole point of a vaccine, CDC guidance, is what we're following.
Republican Senator Ted Cruz refusing to wear a mask while speaking to the press yesterday. Just for the record, official guidance from the CDC advises to continue regular precautions in public places, like wearing a mask, even when fully vaccinated. Thanks, Ted Cruz, for guiding us to the CDC. Good morning and welcome to Morning Joe. It is Thursday, March 25th. With us, we have White House reporter for the Associated Press, Jonathan Lemire, and president of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book, The World, A Brief Introduction. Richard Haass is with us this morning. So, Jonathan Lemire, you heard Casey just talking about it, the president holding that press conference today. What can we expect?
Well, it's President Biden's first solo news conference. It's 60-odd days into his administration. And he's gone the longest without having one of these events than any of his predecessors in decades. And I know certainly there's some talk, particularly among West Wing aides, that this matters more inside the Beltway than to average Americans. But it is important. It's a chance for reporters to have an extended back and forth with the president, providing answers and clarity for the American public. And it comes at a crucial moment for this president. Their plan originally was to use today as part of their victory lap for their $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill. We certainly should expect to hear plenty of that from the president, as well as, rightly, touting his successes distributing the vaccine across the country. But it also comes at a moment when he's facing a number of unplanned external challenges. We talked about the influx of migrants at the southern border. We have members of his own party threatening to block his nominees because of a lack of Asian American representation. We have, of course, the twin mass shootings of the last week or so. So he's going to be pressed on topics that will be challenging for him to face. He is going to have to lay out what his agenda is, in particular, what the future of the filibuster is. How can he get legislation done on any of these crises?
Any concerns from the White House internally about this upcoming press conference? Are they concerned that he's going to have things thrown at him that they weren't expecting originally? Are they concerned with how he responds?
Well, certainly they're downplaying the importance of this. They point to all the other avenues in which President Biden engages with the press and the public. That's standard West Wing rhetoric. But of course, there's some concern. It's an unscripted moment. President Biden himself, he has deemed himself a, quote, gaffe machine. We have seen him sometimes get in trouble when he speaks off the cuff. And they're fearful that something could turn into a news cycle or two, even a temporary distraction while they're pushing forward with their message. But they also see it as an opportunity, a chance to talk about their successes, but also plans for what's all that's on his plate right now.
Well, and then the backdrop of this, of course, there is new evidence this morning that members of groups that attacked the U.S. Capitol on January 6th coordinated with one another. The paramilitary group, the Oath Keepers, and a similar group, the Proud Boys, were in contact with one another in December to plan for potentially violent action in Washington that day. According to a Justice Department memo opposing the pretrial release of Kelly Meggs of Florida, a man accused of being leader of the Oath Keepers and one of the 10 members to play a leading role in the Capitol assault. On December 19th, the court filing said Meggs posted a message on Facebook saying, "This week, I organized an alliance between Oath Keepers, Florida 3%ers, and Proud Boys. We have decided to work together and shut this down. You know what, down. 3 days later, he posted, quote, contact with PB, and they always have a big group force multiplier. Between December 12th and January 4th, prosecutors said Meggs organized and participated in approximately 10 online discussions that were affiliated with the Oath Keepers. He led and planned the group's activities and paid for two hotel rooms in Washington, the court filing said. The documents does not allege that the group formulated a plan to attack the Capitol before arriving in Washington. So, Joe, we have, you know, the government moving forward, but still this massive set of questions around the Capitol attacks. I mean, there are way smaller things that happen across the country that are investigated mm-hmm. and that are seen out
right.
for the public and the world to see, and justice served far quicker than anything that has happened with this incredible assault on our democracy.
Well, it seems, Richard, that the federal prosecutors are really trying to make sure they have everything lined up, especially for those that they want to charge with the conspiracy to commit sedition. You listen to that reporting, and it certainly seems like you are ticking down the requirements of the federal statute for sedition and possibly a conspiracy between these groups.
That's exactly right. When I was listening to Mika, Joe, the word conspiracy was what came to mind. This was not simply spontaneous on January mm-hmm. 5th or 6th. And it also shows that we've got a network here. I'm not saying you have multiple organizations and individuals who are communicating with one another regularly. Well, this is a network. And it was essentially maybe activated around January 6th, but the infrastructure, the loyalty, the inclination was all there beforehand. And that's really worrying, because we don't know yet how extensive it is and to what extent, for example, arresting these people essentially decapitates it, or whether there's a lot of other people out there, which I assume is the case, who are prepared to take their place.
Well, and here you go. Trump supporters who answered the call to come to the Capitol on January 6th also answered the former president's call for donations to fund his legal challenges to election results in surprisingly high numbers. An NBC News analysis of campaign finance filings found that in the 5 weeks after the election, those charged in the Capitol riot increased their political donations by about 75% compared to the 5 weeks leading up to the election. Many had made very few or no donations at all in previous years, but they began escalating their numbers of contributions as Trump was trying to overturn Joe Biden's victory. Among the first 311 people who face federal charges after the January 6th riot, about 90 have histories of making political contributions. And the overwhelming majority of them were made to Trump or his aligned groups and within the past year. The donations shed light on the effectiveness of Trump's post-election messaging, which, according to NBC News, has netted him hundreds of millions of dollars in contributions, many from small dollar donations, like those accused of storming the Capitol.
Well, Jonathan, you can't help but hear about this and go back to that discussion, that shouting discussion that Kevin McCarthy had with Donald Trump when
right.
Donald Trump was insisting that those rioters on Capitol Hill, those terrorists, were not his supporters, but somebody else. And Kevin McCarthy reportedly screamed back at the president, swore at the president, and then said, I'm here. Who do you think blankety blank I am? Well, again, this is almost laughable that we now are seeing that the FBI is tracing these donations back to the people that they're arresting, proving once again that these were not only Donald Trump supporters. These were not only terrorists who were working to commit sedition against the United States of America in the name of Donald Trump, but they were some of his most fierce supporters.
And it shows how then President Trump stoked this conspiracy theory, the big lie that there was election fraud, that he was the right winner of the November 6th election, when, of course, none of that was true. And it shows he'd been laying the groundwork for weeks. He had been creating this fervor here among his supporters who, for a time, this reporting shows, were content to donate money. But also, he was building up anticipation to January 6th. We know the tweets about how he said that day was going to be wild. And certainly, a lot of his supporters took that very seriously and literally, and they showed up that day. One would hope that a report like this would eliminate the Republican talking point, which we still hear sometimes, that these supporters, that these rioters weren't Trump supporters, that they may have been, members of Antifa posing as Trump Life supporters. Well, that's quite the long game if that's the case. It is nonsensical. On one hand, this is certainly logical and makes sense, but still disturbing to see. And it shows just how long Trump whipped this up into a frenzy that exploded into violence.
Absolutely. And a delegation of White House officials and members of Congress traveled to the southern border yesterday to tour a health and human services facility being used to house migrant children. An NBC News crew accompanied the delegation and toured a facility in Carrizo Springs, Texas. Officials say there are just over 766 minors at the facility, which has a capacity of 952. NBC News correspondent Gabe Gutierrez was given exclusive media access to tour that facility, and here's part of his report.
This facility in Carrizo Springs, Texas, is home to 766 unaccompanied minors, all teen boys. Officials say more than 100 have tested positive for COVID. After mounting pressure on the Biden administration, a network camera was allowed inside today. We saw the intake center, where kids are tested for COVID and given duffel bags of clothes. There's a dining hall, classrooms and dorm rooms, holding four kids each. It was orderly, and the children were calm, some wearing hats they knit themselves. We saw kids playing soccer outside. We were not allowed to speak to them, but members of the congressional delegation did.
And Gabe joins us now from Carrizo Springs near the U.S. border with Mexico. Gabe, first of all, give us a sense of what it was that wasn't allowing the media in before yesterday and any insights. And also, with so many people, how are they handling COVID, the COVID crisis in there?
Hey there, Mika. Good morning. So, yes, the Biden administration had been facing this criticism for not allowing journalists. And earlier in the week, they actually did release handout video from other CBP facilities, not this HHS facility. I'll get to the difference between the two in a moment. But the real overcrowding at this point is happening in those customs and border protection facilities. Now, the Biden administration has said because of COVID protocols, they weren't allowing reporters in, privacy concerns as well. But if I can say really quickly, Mika, yes, right now, the overcrowding, the kids being in those facilities for longer than 10 days when the legal limit is 72 hours, those are the Customs and Border Protection facilities where they first go after they're picked up at the U.S. border. Then they're brought to facilities like this one run by HHS, and this is where they stay until they're they find them a sponsor or a family member inside the country where then they could be placed in the care of that family member. In terms of COVID, Mika, we did learn that more than 100 children here inside this facility, 108 children, have tested positive for COVID-19, and they're given this COVID test when they arrive. Those that have COVID are then put in special negative pressure dormitories where they go in isolation, and then they're tested while they're here. Just some insights, you know, having been here, and, you know, we went along with this congressional delegation as well as White House officials who were a pool camera so that we were able to then distribute the video to other media outlets. But I had been here at this facility in 2019. It was actually open under the Trump administration. Then it was shut down a couple weeks after it opened because there weren't enough children here. It actually had a larger capacity back then. Couple of things that HHS thinks have changed. Number one, COVID has reduced their bed capacity by about 40%, according to an HHS official. They also say that during the tail end of the Trump administration, there was a hiring freeze in the agency. And so that's part of the reason they say that this was slow to ramp up at the end of the Trump administration. And then once the Biden administration took effect, still there are questions of the Biden administration, why it is taking so long. Rank and file border agents are saying that HHS has been slow to take these minors. And so that is causing the overcrowding in the Customs and Border Protection facilities. Mika.
All right. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez, thank you very, very much for your reporting this morning. And of course, there were a lot of questions about access. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki yesterday acknowledged that the administration allowed video access to a, quote, aspirational facility rather than one where conditions are problematic.
The access being granted today for the pool is of a facility that is aspirational of where you want to move these children. Mm-hmm. What about access to the facilities where there is overcrowding and there is an actual problem? Why was this one chosen over those?
We're also open to providing access there, and this is just the first step in a process of providing greater access to the media.
You agree, though, that you've chosen the facility that is the aspirational facility as opposed to the problem at this moment?
Well, I would say we all agree that the Border Patrol facilities are not places where children should be. They are children should be moving more quickly through those facilities. That is what our policy central focus is right now, as you know, Jeff. And there are also it's also becoming a public health concern because of the number of kids who are moving through those facilities and
why
the fact.
Why not show those to the
American people? We will, and we are working with the Border Patrol and with DHS to determine how we can do that.
So, Jonathan Lemire, this is. This is problematic. I mean, look, I know Jen Psaki well, but reporters should be allowed into all the facilities. And when you only allow reporters into the aspirational ones, it leads to more questions. Like, are reporters being used to sort of sell the best part of this? We got to see what's going on. I mean, not Nike boxes of new shoes. So what am I missing here?
No, Mika, you're absolutely right. This is the press has been, of course, pushing for access to all of these facilities. And certainly that tour yesterday, though a step in the right direction, isn't going to silence the questions about what are the conditions really like there at the border. The White House certainly, look, they point to the idea this is a challenge that they inherited, that the Trump administration had, in their estimation, broken the nation's immigration system and put these conditions in place at the border. The White House has said, look, we still need time to figure this out, and we have concerns about privacy of the minors there, as well as, of course, safety conditions because of the pandemic. But this is a challenge. They own this now, and they know that, and they need to be able to sort that out. And President Biden yesterday took a step in that direction too, where he anointed Vice President Harris and said that she would be the point person for the administration's response to the conditions at the border. And the vice president to this point had sort of been without a portfolio. And this is a big step. This is sort of her first big item gives off the message that the administration is taking this crisis seriously, but also, of course, poses a lot of risk and a lot of responsibility on her shoulders.
So, Richard Haass, a lot of questions on how best to resolve this crisis. We had a Democratic congressman on yesterday, Congressman Cuellar, who said we needed to be humane, but at the same time, the congressman, a Hispanic, a Democrat, said we also have to show humanely the United States returning migrants back to their home countries to send that message. That's one part of it, I guess, according to the congressman. But what about the root of the problem? What should we do specifically in terms of foreign aid to these countries where most of these migrants are escaping horrific conditions? And how do we make sure that the money that's spent there, the American tax dollars that are spent there, don't go to corrupt governments?
Joe, there's actually two problems, and I think we just need to unpack it for a second. A lot of people are coming, particularly adult men, and those are typical migrants. And that's because of, in particular, the economic differential, say, between Mexico and the United States. And the answer there is to work something out with the Mexican government. It's to get vaccines into the hands of Mexican authorities. It's to get the Mexican economy going again. Easier said than done, given their leadership. But that's one problem. Indeed, that's the kind of problem 25, 30 years ago that NAFTA essentially resolved, when Mexico's economic growth rates began to approximate our own. That's one thing. The other thing are people, particularly young people, escaping from Central America because of gangs, because of violence. They're coming north and so forth. There's a longer term problem, what you are getting at, of providing aid to these governments to essentially help them do what governments are meant to do, which is provide security, have a better penal system, policing system, military system. That's a long term effort. So we should start it. And any aid should be made conditional to these governments. The problem is some of them won't accept aid on those terms. The Mexican government, for example, is very reticent to be seen cooperating with us. The kinds of things we did in Colombia for years, in many cases, is just simply not on. These governments are not willing to be seen to be so close to the United States. So that means we're going to have pressure at the border, and that's where capacity to process asylum cases become important. One other idea, which is controversial, is don't consider people, young people, if they're over, say, 15. Send back or over 16, treat people who are 16, 17 as adults and not treat them as unaccompanied minors.
Meanwhile, new NBC News reports that the Biden transition team and career government officials say they began sounding an alarm in early December on the need to increase shelter space for a larger number of migrant children expected to soon be crossing the border. But the Trump administration didn't take action until just days before the inauguration. That's according to two Biden transition officials and a U.S. official with knowledge of the discussions. Let's bring in one of the reporters on this story, NBC News correspondent Julia Ainsley. So, Julia, tell us exactly what happened and what triggers weren't pulled, what wasn't done right before the transition.
Well, Mika, we know that in early December, when the transition finally got off the ground, that Biden officials asked the then Trump administration if they could go ahead and start the process of opening more beds in, you know, those aspirational facilities, facilities like the one that Gabe got to tour yesterday, because they knew that the numbers were climbing. You could already see the numbers of unaccompanied minors climbing late fall, especially because at that point, a judge had said that the Trump administration policy of keeping out unaccompanied children during the pandemic was not lawful. So the numbers were going up. They said, look, we're looking at the data. We know you're looking at this data. You need to start the process now, because it takes a long time before you actually get one of those facilities up and running. Instead, they said they sat on their hands. And this isn't just coming from Biden transition officials. It's coming from career officials who've worked under multiple presidents at Health and Human Services, saying that they saw the data, they knew the numbers were going up, and now is the time. Instead, really, the Trump administration just gave no reason. They kept the status quo. Mm. And it wasn't until January 15th that then HHS Secretary Alex Azar started the process to even begin site tours. After that, we know there's a very long process to actually get the approvals, get the contracts out, get the people in there, and open beds for children. They were already at a reduced capacity, as Gay pointed out, by 40% just because of COVID, that they weren't able to use all of the space that they had. So what I'm told is it was incredibly frustrating. And this was brought up not just once, but at least once a week, starting at the very beginning of those transition conversations.
All right. NBC's Julia Ainsley, thank you very much for your reporting this morning. Let's get to some other stories making headlines this morning. After surpassing his goal of 100 million shots within 100 days, President Biden is expected to announce a new vaccination goal during his upcoming news conference today. One White House official tells NBC News that the president's new goal is, quote, ambitious, while declining to give details. Last week, the president suggested he'd be doubling the previous goal.
Richard Haas, let me get you in here really quickly, because I read something in the Times, I think yesterday, David Leonhardt, I believe, was talking about how all the news that we ever reported about COVID over the past year was negative. Well, there weren't a lot of bits of news that were worthy of a parade, but still, I get his point. You look at vaccinations and you look at how we're stacking up right now with Europe and other parts of the world. It's extraordinary. That didn't just happen. The previous administration, the Trump administration, had Operation Warp Speed, which worked really well. The current administration has handled the logistics far better than the previous administration ever could. But you taken together, just talk about, let's just stop for 1 minute, because everybody runs this country down all the time. Talk about how extraordinary it is that a year later, we've rolled this out and we're giving vaccinations at such a rapid pace when many people told us a year ago we wouldn't have a vaccination for 4 years.
It's exactly right. This is an amazing accomplishment. First, the science, what these companies were able to do in a short amount of time and these new techniques that were developed, which, by the way, are going to have fantastic payoff beyond even COVID. This really is transformational. Then you had the intervention of the Trump administration, essentially upfront government financial support for the companies, and in some cases to bet on vaccines, even before they knew they were good. They took a big risk and they built up supply. And now you have this administration doing two additional things. One is ramping up government involvement in the production to, so now we're at, 3 million or so jabs a day, and obviously putting much more emphasis, a real improvement on the distribution, on the implementation of the ability to distribute vaccines around the country. This is an amazing public-private partnership. People are going to look at this, whether it's Harvard Business School or what, Joe. And this is for people who talk about the deep state and always to criticize government, guess what? This is a really good example when government working with the private sector can make a miracle happen.
Yeah.
All right. Still ahead on Morning Joe, the top two Senate leaders, Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, square off in a fight over voting rights. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
The UN Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, responds to emergencies and provides long-term solutions for refugees. They provide aid in over 130 countries, including Ukraine, Syria, Afghanistan, and Sudan, where people are forced to flee from war and persecution at their greatest moment of need. UNHCR helps and protects refugees by providing food, shelter, medical care, and other life-saving essentials. The agency jumpstarts relief in three key ways. They transport core relief items stored in even the most remote areas of the world. They deploy expert emergency staff trained to help in crisis situations. And they transfer funds directly to support the emergency. Because of generous supporters and donors, UNHCR can scale up its response within 72 hours of a large-scale emergency. Your support helps provide life-saving aid for refugees whenever and wherever emergencies occur. Donate to USA for UNHCR by visiting unrefugees.org/donation.
Older will heal, but this scar will always be there. My daughter's generation will always bear the burden of a national government that did nothing to protect. I'm not asking anybody here to show the courage that Officer Talley showed, or the other men and women of law enforcement who constantly have to deal with the inability of this places. Just asking us to show an ounce of their courage by doing whatever we can to keep weapons of war out of our communities.
Senator Michael Bennet of Colorado speaking yesterday on the Senate floor about victims of the Boulder shooting. The man accused of killing 10 people after opening fire inside a Boulder grocery store is expected to make his first court appearance later this morning. The 21-year-old will be formally charged with the mass shooting and is expected to face 10 counts of first-degree murder. If convicted, he could face a mandatory life sentence without the possibility of parole. Last year, Colorado removed the death penalty. Hundreds of people lined the streets yesterday during a procession to honor one of the victims, fallen officer Eric Talley, as his body was transported from the coroner's office to a funeral home. And last night, the first of several planned candlelight vigils was held to remember the 10 lives lost in the supermarket shooting. Now to the war of words between the majority and minority leaders of the Senate at a hearing on Democrats' sweeping voting reform bill. The proposal, which passed the House with no Republican support, is aimed at countering the more than 250 bills that restrict voting at the state level.
Instead of doing what you should be doing when you lose an election in a democracy, attempting to win over those voters in the next election, Republicans instead are trying to disenfranchise those voters. Shame on them. It's one of the most despicable things I have seen in all my years. Shame, shame, shame. Some of these voter suppression laws in Georgia and other Republican states smack of Jim Crow rearing its ugly head once again.
States are not engaging in trying to suppress voters whatsoever. This is clearly an effort by one party to rewrite the rules of our political system. Talk about shame. If anybody ought to be feeling any shame around here, it's turning the FEC into a partisan prosecutor. The majority controlled by the president's party to harass and intimidate the other side. That's what you ought to be ashamed about.
Elizabeth Warren has said that the filibuster is based on racism. Is it?
No, the filibuster predates the debates over civil rights. It goes back to the beginning of the country. The filibuster started well before we got into the civil rights debates that have occurred off and on over the history of the country. So the derivation of the filibuster was not related to race or civil rights.
Let's bring in White House correspondent for Politico and co-author of The Playbook, Eugene Daniels. He's also an MSNBC contributor. So from what we know, and as we've been following the history of this story, is Mitch McConnell correct in his answer?
Historians would tell you no, that he's not. And I think when people are talking about it having Jim Crow era, like it's smelling of Jim Crow, is because of Strom Thurmond and him standing up there for, I think it was 24 hours, filibustering. So that's what people are talking about. I think Mitch McConnell knows that because people, you know, have said that before. And when you talk to Black leaders especially, they continue to push that. There's been this conversation about the filibuster happening forever. But it's been more clear, especially after President Obama during John Lewis's funeral called it a relic of the Jim Crow era, the idea of it being racist, being tied to that, and also now Democrats basically having to choose whether or not they want to pass this voting rights legislation and make sure that Black and brown people have greater access, better access to voting, or allow this filibuster to stay in place. And that's something that Black leaders in the voting rights areas and civil rights areas are going to continue to push Democrats like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema on.
Richard Haass, things have come at us so quickly over the past 5 years that sometimes it's hard to get a perspective. But let's just talk about what we're looking at here with the Republican Party. And Chuck Schumer is right. You and I, both former Republicans, both loyal Republicans for decades. You served several presidents in the White House. You have our former party actually starting to take on the characteristics of center-right extreme parties in Poland and Hungary, and actually state by county chair, their goal, their talking points all have to do with restricting voting rights, making this country less democratic, understanding that they have to be the anti-democratic party if they're going to keep losing the popular vote every 4 years. And it really is. It is stunning that we're watching this debate play out. And yes, perhaps the Democrats are overreaching in some portions of H.R. 1, but the instinct is correct, and that is the need to push back on anti-democratic forces that have taken over the Republican Party.
Yeah, Joe, I'm old enough to remember, as are you, when the Republican Party was happy to engage the battle of ideas. And thinking of this as a political marketplace, you would say, here's the right role, a more limited role, say, for the government in the economy. Or here's the right foreign policy, a stronger American foreign policy abroad. And then you essentially put it to the American people. That's political competition. Instead, it's as almost as if the Republican Party acknowledges that its current agenda, its current body of thoughts, can't win in a free and fair political marketplace. So what they're trying to do is narrow the marketplace. And what they're trying to do is essentially reduce the opportunity for vote in a country, by the way, where already we have a problem where Americans vote at relatively low levels compared to many other democracies. So, yeah, this is a really sad and troubling development.
Eugene, Senator Angus King, independent of Maine, who has long been viewed as a supporter of the filibuster and not wanting to change it, wrote an op-ed this week suggesting that he would be amenable to changes to it, particularly on voting rights legislation, saying it would be a special case. Now, you identified the two senators earlier that a lot of Democrats are watching here, Sinema and Manchin, who have said they'd be reluctant to offer similar changes to the filibuster. But there seems like momentum is building, and the White House is sending signals that they, too, as much as President Biden would like to keep the filibuster, he is, as an Senate institutionalist, he's willing to see it go if it means pushing his agenda. Where do you see the state of play right now?
Yeah, I think that's right. We're starting to see more Democrats, like you said, Angus King, realizing that if you want to do anything, then you're going to have to be able to get that 51 votes or convince 10 Republicans. And right now, that doesn't seem to be the case. Joe has said on this show before, because there's been talk about what happens if you're in the minority. And, you know, maybe that's the point, right? As Joe has put it, it is you should be able to pass your legislation, and elections should have consequences. And that's something that I hear from Democrats when I ask them, are they worried about blowback from this? And what we're going to start seeing, and I talked to your guys' colleague, Reverend Al Sharpton, about this, we're going to start seeing Black leaders go to, he says, to West Virginia, to Arizona, and saying that Manchin and Sinema are, in effect, supporting racism by not getting rid of the filibuster. And I think that's something that we're going to be seeing. And also they're tying it to the fact that you're not going to be able to get anything done. And that's something that other activists are working on as well. And I'm not really sure how long Democrats, whether it's Joe Biden or others, can kind of keep those forces at bay, because the Black vote is the most important vote for Democrats.
Hmm. Politico's Eugene Daniels, thank you so much. We'll be reading the playbook this morning. We appreciate it. Two separate House panels debated yesterday over the presence of extremism in the U.S. military and the rise in domestic terrorism, both of which were highlighted during the January 6th Capitol attack. It comes as more former military and domestic extremist group members are being charged for their roles in the deadly riot by the day. Joining us now, two lawmakers that oversaw those discussions, Chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Congressman Adam Smith. Also with us, a member of that committee and chairwoman of the Intelligence and Counterterrorism Subcommittee, Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan. She previously served as a Middle East analyst for the CIA. Great to have you both.
Adam, thanks so much for being with us. I'm curious what you're finding now. We've heard for a few years concerns about extremism in military, in America's armed forces. How widespread is the problem?
Well, we don't know, and that's a starting point. But Secretary Austin has made it clear that this is a challenge in the ranks. He talked about, you know, during his testimony when he was being confirmed, it was really compelling testimony about what it was like coming up in the military as a Black man and where it's gone and some of the things that he encountered. There is no question, as we've seen across the country in the last 4 years, with the rise of white nationalism, the rise of white supremacy, and a troubling crossover, not just in the January 6th riots, so that certainly is the greatest example of it, but in many instances where you have members of the military who are part of these groups. And what we discovered in the hearing yesterday is the military really hasn't done that much at the moment to find out, okay, who might be affiliated with these groups within the military. So what we want to do right now is at least, you know, dive into the problem. And with the Republicans yesterday, part of the problem in their response was they sort of they took on the role of sort of defense attorneys and say, well, if you can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, why are we talking about it? I think there is enough evidence right now of the problem. We've seen it across the country. There is considerable evidence that within the ranks of the military, we have issues with racism. We need to figure out what they are, how they're being addressed. This is really crucial to making sure we have our military as strong as possible. Yep. So we're at the beginning of this, but we need to find out what the problem is and then what the best for our committee to do that.
Congresswoman Slotkin, what are we finding out about the people who were at the riot, the people being charged? And maybe it's impatience, media impatience, but why is it so hard to make a deduction here on what exactly was going on? Because it does kind of seem so basic.
Well, I think, I mean, we react into the fact that a disproportionate number of the truly organized, truly prepared folks who came in the Capitol on January 6th, who intended, we believe, to come in the Capitol long before the morning of January 6th, had a military background. They were either in the military or veterans of the military. And so I think we've seen that in the arrest reports. Listen, it has to be methodical. And I don't think it's a secret anymore that there's overlapping law enforcement agencies that have an interest in what goes on at the Capitol. So, you know, maybe it seems like it's taking a long time. What I think is taking a long time is that we don't have agreement on a 9/11 style commission. A truly sort of stand back, objective, bipartisan look at what happened. I think we need that. That's been kind of frustrating to a number of members that we haven't been able to come to agreement on getting started on that.
That's such a good point. And Joe, I mean, we can't even agree on the fact that this needs to be investigated. We can't even agree that this requires a 9/11 style commission to look at a mass assault on our democracy in process. I don't know. I mean, where are we if we can't do that?
Partisan.
Of course.
The proposal.
Why wouldn't it be?
The proposal that was put forward would have put 7 Democrats on the committee and 4 Republicans. That's not going to work. You can reverse that to 7 Republicans, 4 Democrats. That wouldn't work. The House and the Senate are split 50-50. They need to figure out how to get 6 Republicans and 6 Democrats on the committee. 6 Republicans and 6 Democrats can be like jury selection. Like, they can have a right to dismiss certain members there. And they can keep the wing nuts and the backbenchers who are going to be doing this for press clippings rather than getting to the truth. They can veto those members. But again, they need to move forward with a 9/11 style commission. And they need to do it in a bipartisan manner. And I can't believe there aren't enough adults and leadership in the Republican and the Democratic Party to figure out how to put your country first and get that done. And there are so many questions to ask. And one of those questions, we just put it up on the screen, Chairman Smith, is the fact that 20% of the people that rioted on January the 6th reportedly members are former members of the United States military.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Yeah, and that is deeply disturbing. And that's, well, you know, big part of the reason why we had the hearing yesterday. But I think what came out of our hearing yesterday gives you a little bit of insight as to why we're having so much trouble get this commission formed. The Republican response whenever we start talking about this is to equate this with this, you know, the right wing noise machine talking about, you know, woke, excessive wokeism, if you will. The idea that we're going to go out and persecute people just for something they thought or just for something they said. That's certainly where Matt Gaetz and others went yesterday, is the idea that you're even going to try to address the riot on Capitol Hill, that you're going to try to address right-wing extremism, or what we've seen in the battle over voting rights. You know, they claim that their effort to shut people down from voting is to stop the rise of this unfair left-wing, you know, sort of mythical attack that they have in their head. And as long as they focus on that and say everything we try to do is just excessive, it's not. We are trying to get at a very real problem. And I will say this. I know there are Republicans, certainly on our committee, most bipartisan committee in Congress, but elsewhere, who want to address this. But the pull of the Trump people to make it into a deep-seated partisan political fight, no matter what we say, to sort of wish the problem away, to imagine that white nationalism, white supremacy, that this doesn't exist, it's a very strong pull that the Trump people are doing. And it makes it difficult to get to that common sense bipartisan agreement.
Congresswoman Slotkin, this is obviously extremely important work to identify those in the military that are hold extremist beliefs or racist beliefs. Forgive the perhaps overly simple question, but what can be done about it? What can be done to prevent people like that from being in the military? What sort of steps or screening can be done to weed out people who have these sort of beliefs in the armed forces?
Well, first of all, I do want to say that there are some regulations, rules already on the books, right? It's not an open season for anyone who wants to join the military. I've visited, I can't tell you how many recruiting stations in and around Michigan. And, you know, if you've got a swastika tattoo when you come in for your physical exam to try and get into the military, that's going to be a flag. That's going to be something that's going to potentially be prohibitive. It should be prohibitive. So there are rules. I think we need better data collection. And then, frankly, I just don't see a better person than General Austin to be the one who leads on this issue. He's already had a one-day stand down for the entire force to talk about this issue. I've heard from people who went through that. But, you know, someone who grew up not only as a Black man, but who was involved in uncovering nests of skinheads, you know, in the 82nd Airborne, this is someone who has real experience with this. So I'm going to let him have the time that he needs to tackle it. But I think what I got the impression from yesterday, from my colleagues across the aisle, is one, a real reluctance to even look at this issue. And it made me think, if, you know, we have been so focused over the past 20 years on rooting out people in the military who might have a link to a foreign terrorist group, who might be sympathetic to an Al-Qaeda message, to an ISIS message. We've been hyper-focused on that. So why can't we say take the same vigor and energy and put it into rooting out people who might be white supremacists?
Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin and Congressman Adam Smith, thank you both very much for everything you're doing and for being on the show this
Greatly
morning.
Greatly appreciate it. Richard Haass, I've been reading over the past year or so, real concerns about right-wing extremists and moving into the German security forces. And then you read that 20% of the people who tried to overthrow the government on January the 6th, 20% of the people who committed sedition against the United States were members of the military or former members of the military. We've got a real problem, don't we?
We do have a real problem. One of the things I hope they look at, in addition to trying to get a 9/11-like commission, Joe, is military education. We should be looking at the curriculum in every one of the service academies, in every one of the staff schools, which soldiers have to go through as they go up the ladder, and making sure that we essentially teach civics and we deal with these issues as people move up the chain of command. And I would hope that that would be something that would get a lot of attention. The kind of one day that Secretary Austin had a stand down, that's fine, but that's one day. We have got to institutionalize civics in the military educational system.
All right. Thank you so
Thank
much,
you, Richard.
Richard.
Coming up, perhaps the strongest voice in Congress when it comes to sexual assault in the military, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand will be our guest. We'll get her thoughts on what's happening in Washington as far as the filibuster and what's happening back in her home state of New York with Governor Andrew Cuomo. Morning Joe is back in just a moment.
Massive cargo ship got spun around and stuck in the Suez Canal, blocking more than 100 ships. Look at this thing. It's giant. Look at that. If you look closely, the ship has a tiny bumper sticker that says student driver. So, I mean,
come on.
Traffic is backed up for miles and hundreds of ships are delayed. Do you know how stressful it is to parallel park when there's someone behind you? Imagine blocking a whole hemisphere. And you know what I'm saying?
Wow. All right, the massive container ship that ran aground in the Suez Canal, halting traffic in one of the world's busiest waterways, is still stuck after more than 24 hours. The ship, operated by Taiwanese shipping company Evergreen, became horizontally wedged the waterway following heavy winds. Multiple tugboats were sent to the scene to start a refloat operation to dislodge the 1,300-foot vessel, which can take several days. None of the 25 crew members or any of the cargo has been harmed. Preliminary investigations have ruled reason for the grounding. The ship has completely halted traffic on the canal, which in 2020 saw more than 19,000 ships pass through on an average of 51 ships a day. This is...
Yeah, let's go.
Like...
Yeah, this is
bad. What?
Let's go to our naval correspondent. Captain Richard Haas. Hey, Captain. So the Suez Crisis of 1956 and the Suez Crisis of 2021.
Very different.
I think we may be able to resolve this one a bit easier than the Brits were able to resolve the one in 56.
Yeah, I doubt this one will bring down the British government. If it goes on long enough, it may bring down the Egyptian government because they're so dependent on revenues. They'll probably make gasoline prices higher at the pump. What, 10% of the world's oil goes through there.
Wow. Hey, so Richard, I had somebody yesterday tweet during the show that they would love for me to ask guests and friends what they're reading right now or if there's a great book they've read over the past year during COVID. What about you? Other than, of course, all the great writing that you do yourself, what are you reading right now? What should our viewers read right now? Or is there a great book that you've read over the past couple months?
For fun, total diversion, I read Carl Hyacinth's most recent book. I think it was called Squeeze Me, just for escapism. And then for serious stuff, Margaret Macmillan's most recent book on the history of war. Really just – and I've just started a new book, about thinking again, about basically learning to jettison all the things that we thought we knew and being open to new ideas. I'm finding that interesting as well.
And who's the author of that?
It's Adam. What's Adam's last name? I'm sorry. I'm having a mental block.
Think again. Yeah, that's all right. It happens. All right. Those sound like some fascinating choices. All right, Richard. Thank you so much. Adam Grant.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm told by Alex it's Adam Grant thinking again.
Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. Still, thank you, Richard.
Still ahead, Texas Congresswoman Veronica Escobar will be our guest. She says when it comes to the issue of immigration, what she's asking for doesn't include open borders. We're back in 2 minutes.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.